Institute. I'm Nance Haxton, and this is A Matter of Crime. A Matter of Crime takes you behind the headlines and gets you a seat beside Australia's leading criminologists and legal scholars. Together, we'll unravel why laws are made, why they're broken, and how we navigate the aftermath. Today, we have a double-shot crim and tonic with Griffith University Research Fellow Juliet Davis and special guest Griffith University Criminology PhD student Sam Nicol. Jack the Ripper is synonymous with London's East End, but why have these murders held the public imagination for more than 130 years? Join Juliet and Sam as they step back in time to the autumn of terror and shine a light on this shadowy figure.
So, Sam... Today, we are going to be talking about Jack the Ripper, because it's part of our union rules that if you do a podcast about crime, you have to talk about Jack the Ripper at some point.
Absolutely.
So, did you want to chat a little bit about what drew you towards Jack the Ripper or to violence in the East End?
Yeah, I think there's a general kind of fascination with Jack the Ripper worldwide, but I guess my interest, because I worked in that area, I worked for the Metropolitan Police for a few years, and specifically as a crime scene examiner in the borough of Tower Hamlets, which is where Whitechapel is situated, where obviously Jack the Ripper committed those atrocious crimes. So working in that environment, attending to a lot of violent crime scenes in that area, I guess kind of brings it home and keeps the interest alive in relation to what happened a century before.
So maybe you could describe for the listeners what the East End of London is like today. We're going to be talking about what it was like in 1888, but, you know, put us in the place. What's it like?
Yeah, I mean, it's like many areas of London, it's very diverse. I mean, you have very affluent areas and in very close proximity, you also have kind of more impoverished areas. And I think when you're working in that environment, I kind of have a tainted view of that area, yeah. Because obviously the majority of scenes that I was going to were generally kind of violent scenes, and I was kind of seeing some of the more kind of impoverished areas there. But it always kind of feels a little bit, the East End has got this kind of notoriety, and it's kind of got this feel around it of having a tradition of sort of gangs and violence and stuff like that. It's changed a lot over the years, but it's still got that kind of undertone, I think, to it. And it made it a very interesting place to work.
The way I know then how I sort of started to learn a little bit more about Jack the Ripper was I was actually a tour guide. So I did my master's study in London, and so my work was to do tours. And so I did tours of, you know, Buckingham Palace and the sort of the West End of London, but I also did Jack the Ripper tours. Mm. And so my experience is possibly a little bit similar, is that a lot of the time I was in the East End, it was nighttime, it was, you know, quite dark, and I was talking about gruesome killings for tourists. But what I find is really interesting is, unlike in the West of London, where there are sort of broader esplanades, lots of lighting, big sidewalks, pavements, in the East End, it is a little more pokey. The streets are narrower. There's a kind of Victorian brick which is used, so it's quite dark. And there's all these little alleyways. And it's quite interesting because the East End was also the site of so much bombing in the Second World War. So when I did these tours, I was, you know, trying to take people to places where, you know, these events had occurred. And there are some places that still remain, like Mitre Square, where a body was found, one of the victims of Jack the Ripper, supposedly. And so that still exists. But so many of these sites don't, because they were totally destroyed in the Second World War.
Yes.
And so you also have that history as well as this other sort of moment of great violence in the East End coming from the bombing. So it is a really fascinating area, and it's got so much history. So I think we may as well just dive into it and talk a little bit more about the Autumn of Terror. As you know, the killings of Jack the Ripper is known. And so this took place, I mean, there's arguments as to whether there had been killings beforehand, killings afterwards, but the kind of traditional dates that are given are the 31st of August to the 9th of November 1888, which, interestingly enough, happened 222 years after another massive seminal event in London's history, which was the Great Fire of London, 1666. Yes. So 1888, it's a great date for a tour guide, easy to remember. So there's five women known as the Canonical Five who are known as the victims of this killer who's known as Jack the Ripper. So did you want to talk through them briefly, that give their names and talk a little bit about them? Or
yeah, I was just going to mention one point there, which was the fact that there were a series of murders around that time in Whitechapel, and there was debate around which were attributable to Jack the Ripper himself. It's kind of reflective of the area, I guess, at the time, that there was this kind of violence in the area, and the fact that there was this cluster of murders, and they're trying to work out which of these murders were committed by Jack the Ripper.
And violence against women.
Absolutely.
And I think a problem that we do come across is, I do want to talk more about these women and kind of try and put them at the centre of this story, because that's really important. But often they are sort of herded into one group, they become a little bit faceless, a little bit nameless, and all the attention goes on the killer. So I think that's really important. We will talk about that more. But also, people tend to dismiss the killings before and after, because you have these canonical five, and then all these other women who, at least four, who died in this area of time. As soon as it's determined that they're not part of this, you know, canon of Jack the Ripper, their deaths are just completely swept to the side. And so I think that's a real problem.
That they don't matter because they weren't committed by Jack the Ripper.
Absolutely. They
were terrible, violent acts.
Mm.
Absolutely. And I think we'll talk a little bit more about the kind of environment and the culture of London around that time. In these cases, you know, people do know the names of the victims, but in violent crime, it's often, you know, worth remembering the names of the victims, and that's what it's really about, and not about the assailant. So, correct me if I'm wrong with this, but the names that I've got here are, the first of these victims was Mary Nichols.
Mm-hmm. Known as Polly Nichols, yeah.
And she was killed on the 31st of August, 1888. Annie Chapman, 8th of September, 1888. Elizabeth Stride, 30th of September, 1888. The same night, Catherine Eddowes.
Is also killed, and that's often known as the double event.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then Mary Kelly was the last of those five.
Mm. Yeah.
And that was the 9th of November, 1888.
And I think what's really interesting, sort of as I was reading up on this before we spoke, there's been a book that's recently been published by a historian whose name is Hallie Rubenhold. And she is the first person to have actually done a history of the five victims of Jack the Ripper. And it was published this year, so 2019, which I find extraordinary that with so much investigation and ripperology about these killings, that this year was the first time that a book on the victims had been published. One of the big things that she drew out of all her research, where she tried to track the lives of these women, is she could not find any evidence that three of these women were sex workers. So there's a great myth that all five women were prostitutes, were sex workers.
Mm.
And yet, three of these women, she finds no evidence for that to be the case. They were probably alcoholics, they were probably homeless. But this overriding myth that all women were prostitutes is something that's probably created at the time and has continued to this day. And she has increasingly getting a lot of trolling over this fact. She had all sorts of ripperologists are coming forward and saying you can't change history, be in the wake of, you know, feminism and the Me Too movement. And so there's this kind of moralistic compulsion to cast all these women in the guise of sex workers, and that's not necessarily the case. I think it's important as we talk about these issues to dive into the economic ramifications and the social anxieties and not get caught up with this sort of moralistic view of the society at the time that so many ripperologists do have about Jack the Ripper and the crimes.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really a time during the Victorian age where there was a a certain expectation of what women should be like, and they should be these kind of homebodies and dutiful wives of men in society. And, and there was a lot of cultural and social change happening at that time. And, you know, women's suffragette movements were beginning to emerge. They were getting some opportunities for voting in local boroughs and things like that. And so the male-dominated publications at the time were framing this as like, this is almost like a deterrent against this kind of behaviour.
Vice. A punishment of vice, essentially. Yeah.
And that still exists. That impression still exists today.
Victim blaming.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's a really interesting context to look at it from as well.
We've gone into a little bit, but I think as we talk about these crimes and we sort of talk about the bigger issues, I think it's really important to hold close the notion that these five women were people. They lived separate lives. They died terrible deaths. And so as we discuss this, we need to hold the fact that these were true people and have respect for that. But maybe we talk about, first of all, why was this such a big deal? I mean, there were killings in the East End beforehand, there were killings afterwards, there was killings, you know, all over the UK, all sorts of social movements, and a lot of violence. It was a violent society. So what was it that caught the public imagination in the case of Jack the Ripper? So I think for me, there's sort of two things that I would draw upon. Firstly, this is a moment in time where modernity, modern society as we know it today, is really starting to evolve. So we have the rise of the press. Literacy rates are going up. We have the sort of the penny rags, the newspapers, people are reading them. Newspaper editors are wanting to get stories that people are going to latch onto in order to sell newspapers. So we have the first time this connection between the public, the media, and the police in one story. And so it really caught the public imagination and held there, because there was all these repeat stories that the press would drum up about these issues. I think the other thing is that because we don't actually know who Jack the Ripper was, this was a name that was created from a letter, supposedly by the killer, probably written by a journalist. Mm. We have no idea who he is. So therefore, he kind of acts as a bit of a cipher, you know, he's this faceless man, and we were able to place on him all the social anxieties of the day. So Niall Christie is a sort of eminent criminologist, sociologist, and so what he speaks about is the ideal victim and the ideal offender. And so we don't think about ideal in terms of like the perfect, but more like the platonic ideal of the person that you think of when you think of a victim, when you think of an offender. And so in a lot of ways, these women aren't ideal victims. You know, they were poor, they were alcoholics, potentially they were sex workers. You know, they're not the little old lady who went out in the middle of the day and was knocked over, and, you know, she was in public, she was doing everything right, she was, you know, completely sober. That is the ideal victim. These women weren't ideal victims. But why do we care about them? I would argue it's not so much about them, and I think we can see that from the fact that we've waited 130 years for a book about them. Instead, we have the ideal offender, because what we have is Jack the Ripper, who nobody knows who it is, who committed atrociously violent crimes, who is the apotheosis of the, you know, the deranged murderer. And so we've been able to see him as this ideal offender and place all our anxieties, all our fears on this one person. And so it's not the fact that we're looking at a case with ideal victims, like we would perhaps in the case of a child sex offender, where we have the ideal victim. Instead, here it's the case of the ideal offender. I think that is a useful sort of criminological frame to think about as we address the killings of Jack the Ripper.
At the time, the 19th century was a time of huge change in London and in Europe generally. Been through the Industrial Revolution, and it had given rise to this kind of middle class. And so there was also this attitude towards poor people, particularly in the East End of London, as this underclass. And so in that context, you could frame Jack the Ripper as like, conspiracy theories abound, but this person to control the poor, and this uprising of revolution and uprising of rights for poor people, rights for women in that environment, and this is some Jack the Ripper is someone who is attacking those people and suppressing that kind of movement, and that's almost like a romanticising. Other people see it as part of the aristocracy who are.
And that was certainly a figure. I mean, we have these pictures of Jack the Ripper, you know, in the top hat with the cane and the cloak. I mean, he's certainly sort of one stereotypical figure of Jack the Ripper as aristocrat. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, the kind of suspicion around medical practices and people in the medical profession, there's a, you know, a suspect deemed as this kind of medical profession because of the removing of organs and stuff like that. And then there's this this other type of suspect, which is the kind of mentally deranged. That's another interesting aspect of, like, people's attitude towards mental health, mental illness at the time. And so this kind of deranged killer who has these kind of mental health problems, mental illness. And one of the suspects, I believe, the theory is that he stopped the killing because he was put into a mental asylum. So whichever kind of way that you want to look at it, you can kind of fit a narrative to what's the most romanticised notion to you. Mm. And I think that's what's kind of captured people's imagination throughout the years in relation to this.
Yeah, I agree, actually. And I mean, you mentioned the aristocrat, you mentioned the doctor, mental health problems, and also I guess the other sort of figure at the time was the sort of the foreign agitator is another kind of figure that we keep seeing. And so if we maybe start at the beginning and talk about Jack the Ripper as aristocrat, I thought that was really interesting what you're talking about in terms of those economic tensions. Becoming a sex worker was not a moral issue, it was an economic issue. Mm-hmm. And perhaps that's the first sort of realization amongst Victorian public that could be the case, that people could become prostitutes purely because of economic reasons rather than because of any moralistic failings on their behalf. Mm. So what I like to think about in terms of London at this time is it's really divided into two. So you have the west of London, which is incredibly wealthy, parts of it incredibly wealthy, because this is the British imperial century. Mm. You know, Britain is ruling so much of the globe. I mean, there's a saying, the sun never sets on the British Empire, because wherever the sun was at any point would hit a part of the British Empire. And so, you know, there's riches coming back from India, from Africa. You know, it's incredibly wealthy. 1851, we've got the Great Exhibition in London, which was a huge success, looking at scientific engineering marvels. So there's a lot of progression going on, a lot of wealth. So that's in largely the West End of London. Then you have the East End, and it's a completely different story. They talk about outcast London. And there's a lot of immigration in the area. It's near the docks, and so people would be coming in, immigrating, particularly from Eastern Europe and Ireland. They're in the east of London. There was this idea that it was a, you know, a den of vice, and everyone was either a prostitute or a criminal, and people were, you know, drinking gin and, you know, lying out on the gutters. But in reality, that didn't seem to be the truth. There was a social reformer at the time called Charles Booth, who had started to do surveys in the east of London. And he published his findings the following year after these killings, so 1889. And so he was looking at these people we're talking about, and he found, in reality, about 1.2% of the population in the East End were lifelong criminals. Mm. About over 60% were just trying to make a decent living. And the way that they did that was largely by working in sweatshops. And so there was this massive exploitation of the poor. And this is starting to come out. You know, we have a year before Marx's Das Kapital is translated into English. So there's this discussion of why do the wealthy have all this access to capital and to funding, whilst the poor are sort of left to do these menial work. A few months before, we've got this amazing labour movement called the Match Girls Strike, where these women and girls who'd been working 14-hour days in a matchmaking factory, they're ingesting phosphorus and getting their jaws eaten away. They're, you know, standing all day. They're getting fines for having dirty feet. They finally get up and strike. And so public opinion starts to shift about women working in the East End, because they're saying, oh my goodness, these women are working in you know, near slave conditions. Perhaps these women who ultimately turn to prostitution have a reason for doing it that is not because they are just fallen women, but because these are the economic realities of their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, with the emergence of the Industrial Revolution, it created this increase in sort of middle class England. Prior to that, there were kind of few sort of landowners in the country who held a large amount of the wealth. And with the Industrial Revolution, this kind of rise of middle class, people were owning factories and owning manufacturing companies. And during this time, it was a time that was perceived as like, if you're poor, it's because you don't work hard enough. And women had a very, you know, particularly in Victorian London, had a very clear place in society, and that didn't involve work. So if they were unmarried or widowed, or they left their husband, they're often, you know, in those environments destitute. And so economically, a way of surviving drove them to potentially prostitution, sex work.
So we can see why the aristocrat may have been seen as a figure for Jack the Ripper. It's just another way, through the killing of these women, it's another way in which the rich exploit the poor. Mm. And, you know, and possibly even for kicks.
So there was this general kind of disdain against people who were poor in the fact that it's of their own doing. Mm. And coupled with that, at the time, there was a lot of kind of social movements happening, particularly around poor people. For example, Charles Dickens was the most popular novelist in that time, and he wrote a lot about poor people and social inequality, and that resonated with people.
So absolutely, I think sort of that economic tension is one thing. You mentioned doctors, which I think is interesting, and so partly the sort of the medical profession is tied into the killings of the Jack the Ripper, because there was discussion at the autopsy of one of the victims that the cuts were done in such a way that they showed some sort of medical knowledge or medical tools, and also, you know, there was some knowledge of anatomy, potentially the fact that certain organs had been removed. And I find this really interesting, actually, because there seems at the same time to be a social anxiety surrounding the role of the medical profession. And a lot of that comes down to the fact that there's lots of advancement in modern medicine occurring at the time. So autopsies are becoming more prevalent. The medical profession wants to know more about the human body, but there's all sorts of rules that surround the use of dead bodies and cadavers to practice medicine. And so there's all this underhand work occurring in order to get bodies for doctors for anatomy. And so probably the most famous instance of this are the body snatchers or resurrection men. And so people would actually go work out which body had been newly buried and actually start to dig up the graves in order to get the corpses for the doctors. You know, if there were deaths by drowning on the Thames, you know, they'd get the bodies and bring them to the hospitals. In connection with this idea of body snatchers, there's the very infamous case of Burke and Hare, which occurred in 1825. This was in Scotland, but I mean, this really infiltrated the entire sort of British consciousness of these body snatchers who initially had been digging up bodies to give the bodies to the doctors, but then over time decided that it was actually more convenient just to kill the people. And so they actually murdered people and then provided the bodies to the doctors. And they were ultimately caught and one was hanged. But, you know, there's this idea that there's something underhand going on. And this celebrated case actually led to the Anatomy Act in 1832, which tried to provide a few more opportunities for doctors to actually practice their anatomy without having to, you know, rely on these body snatchers. And so there was a law that came into place that if a body was left in the workhouse, so the you know, a body of a poor person had been left unclaimed in a workhouse for more than 48 hours, that body could then be used for dissection. Mm. And so that, I can imagine, would be incredibly troubling for the poor of London in particular, where there was a lot of workhouses, as well as elsewhere in Britain, because it meant that you were, you know, co-opted into to having your body cut up after your death without respect. And that would be particularly troubling as well for, you know, particularly those of the Jewish faith or other religious people who felt that they weren't able to be resurrected without their entire body intact. So we see here, you know, this exploitation of the poor yet again, this time by the medical profession, which can very much align with the killings of Jack the Ripper. And as at the same time, we have Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde actually playing in theatres during the killings of Jack the Ripper. So there's, you know, there's a huge view of Jack as potentially a doctor, and they talk about doctors being chased out of neighbourhoods by packs of people who fear that they could be next.
It was interesting as well. I was reading a bit about it, kind of some of the background to asylums at the time, and again, this impression of like what mental illness was, and I think at that time a lot of people, brothers, husbands, fathers, would commit women in the family to mental asylums because they were too opinionated.
Because you only needed sort of a male relative in order to commit a woman to an asylum, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah, you just needed the view of a male relative.
And there was, you know, genuine fear around all of these things, as well as we've already mentioned that this is like the aristocracy kind of controlling the poor people and
exploited in life and in death.
Exactly right. We still see now that poor people are kind of, or people from poor neighbourhoods are kind of blamed for austerity and you know, this fear around immigration, you know, the whole kind of Brexit thing,
and trust the English person to bring up Brexit even in any conversation
in a Jack the Ripper podcast,
comes up, yeah.
But yeah, it's, you know, it's interesting how, you know, there's parallels with the time there with kind of modern society in Britain in some ways. And so if you throw in this kind of masked bandit who was kind of killing poor people in deprived areas, and then you've got this fear around immigration, this fear of like uprising amongst poor.
Because these crimes weren't solved, it is an assumption that even the canonical five were all killed by the same person. I mean, there's all sorts of arguments that this was a creation of the press because it sold a lot more copy for there to be one crazed madman walking around killing women than just women being the subject of multiple assailants and because of a lot of violence in one particular area. So, you know, I think that's a really important point, that there were gangs, there was this violence, and it was a very dangerous place to live, particularly if you were a woman who may have been homeless, who was vulnerable, unprotected, may have been an alcoholic. You know, this was a dangerous place to live, and you didn't need one, you know, solitary serial killer in order to live in fear. This was dangerous enough on its own. And you make that mention of sort of tensions arising from xenophobia because of the increased numbers of immigrants in the area. Also, there was a large amount of anti-Semitism. One of the first people who had been tied to the murders potentially as, you know, Jack the Ripper was a man called John Fizer, who was Jewish. And so there was a lot of sort of anti-Semitism regarding his arrest. There was also a famous phrase that was written above a wall over, I think, Catherine Eddowes' murder.
Yes.
And it was, "The Jews are the men who will not be blamed for nothing." And this was written in chalk. And what's very interesting about that is that the head of the Metropolitan Police actually ordered that notice be scrubbed off the walls before, you know, the public could really see the crime scene. So as soon as the police were there, he ordered for that message to be erased. Now, we don't know if the killer wrote that. We don't know how that's connected. We don't know if it was intended to point the police in the area of the Jewish community or away from the Jewish community. But it was enough that there was some statement about the Jewish community on the wall, potentially in the hand of Jack the Ripper, to have that taken away, because they knew, the police knew, that if that was seen by the public, that would probably cause some sort of pogrom in the East End.
Yeah. And I think that's really interesting, because these murders were particularly gruesome, and for the police officers who were attending these, it would have been undoubtedly some of the worst scenes that they would have come across. And, you know, we don't want to go into the specific details of these, but it's widely known that these deaths were
particularly violent.
Incredibly violent. And so, you know, in some accounts, the police officers who did attend talked about this being the kind of worst thing that they come across.
But it is interesting, given there are so many tensions, that the police weren't willing just to sit back and let the East End tear itself apart. You know, they were stepping into their shoes as the sort of modern protectors that they would try and stop this sort of social unrest from occurring.
Yeah, and to try and it must have been a real challenge at the time to try and keep a lid on all of this that was erupting, because there was so much interest in this case. There was so much interest in the murders generally in Whitechapel and the East End. And there were so many theories around who was committing these acts.
And why haven't the police, why has anyone been convicted? And why is he still walking the streets? You know, the pressure would have been enormous.
Exactly. And so it's kind of interesting to look at it from that context of the pressure to find who's perpetrating this, and then also to kind of keep the public at ease, and to stop these kind of growing tensions that were happening. And as we've already talked about, there were already sort of social uprisings and protests and kind of really prominent movements happening at that time.
It's a spark on the tinder.
Yeah, exactly. And so I kind of find it really interesting as to the sort of pressures that they were under at the time as well.
So talking about, you've already spoken about a bit, but we've talked about why this would have been such a big deal at the day. All those social tensions, all those critical economic, social anxieties that led to this being such a big deal at the time. But why do we talk about it still today? I think, you've touched on the fact that there's still, so much urban poverty, there's tensions regarding immigration, xenophobia, religious tensions. I think another element is this idea of sexualized or gendered violence. We live in a society where the violence against women, killing of women, domestic violence is still so much at the fore, and yet we still carry with it some sort of Victorian ideas about whether the woman had been drinking, whether they'd been going home late at night. There is this still sort of moralistic view of as a woman as a victim. So I think that's still very much the case today. And we still even more and more have this connection between the policing, the community and the press, and how each element sort of tends to feed each other. What is so interesting at that time is by focusing on these acts by one person's very violent, random, sort of lone wolf act, so incredibly violent, so incredibly frenetic and cruel, by focusing everybody's attention on that, it completely helped to ignore all the systemic violence that's going on. We don't question why these women were on the street to begin with. I mean, there's discussion of social reform and things like that, but you don't step behind that and say, well, what about all this sweatshop work? Why are these people working for such low amounts of money? Why don't they have proper accommodation? Why are these people living cheek to jowl with no social security whilst others are so wealthy? You don't have to question the status quo. You don't need to think beyond, why is this man walking the streets killing people? And so it helped to kind of diffuse some of that tension and just focus it purely on these specific acts of violence as opposed to a systemic act of violence. And I think today we can see the same thing, by focusing on, one particular killer of Eurydice Dixon or Jill Maher, we don't necessarily then step back and go, well, why are so many women living in violent relationships? Why are so many women sort of suffering from all this gendered violence? We just focus on these specific acts of violence, and I think that helps to, turn our cheek to everything else that's going on in society.
It's kind of easier to kind of go, well, look at the kind of, for want of a better way of putting it, look at the kind of shiny thing over here. Look at this monster who's done these terrible acts here, rather than looking at the kind of bigger problem. And at the time, you know, Jack the Ripper committed horrendous acts of violence against women, but there was a lot of violence against women and poor people, and the way that immigrants were treated at the time, which was abhorrent. Mm. And so to focus on this kind of demon and highlight that kind of detracts away from these kind of broader social, political, economic issues.
More women were harmed in the Bryant and May matchstick factory. I mean, more women died as a result of ingesting phosphorus whilst working as match women in this time than were killed by Jack the Ripper.
Yeah.
And that's not to take away from the deaths of those women, but we need to talk about more than just that.
That was Griffith University Research Fellow Juliet Davis and special guest, Griffith University Criminology PhD student Sam Nicol. And that's all for this episode of A Matter of Crime. This podcast was produced for the Griffith Criminology Institute by me, Nance Haxton, with production assistance from Michael Adams. Stay up to date with this Griffith University podcast on SoundCloud. Thanks for joining us. Speak to you again.